This is Agent Provocateur with Alan Walsh and Adam Wild.
We are back with a bang. Welcome to season three of Agent Provocateur. I'm Alan Walsh with Adam Wild.
What's going on, Alan?
Hey! Long time no see. Great to see you, Adam.
Good to see you too. Hope it was a good summer. I guess you just kind of wanted to start the episodes off with like the biggest story that we could possibly tackle right now.
You guessed right. You know, after three seasons, you and I are just always thinking the same way. Our guest today is known throughout the sports world as Biz Nasty. He played 202 NHL games for Pittsburgh and Arizona. After retiring from the NHL, he became a media legend with the Spittin' Chicklets podcast, his broadcast work for the Arizona Coyotes, and his larger-than-life presence on TNT as one of the NHL's top media analysts, where he provides expert and engaging commentary. Let's give a big welcome to Paul Biz Nasty Bizanet to Agent Provocateur.
Wow, that's quite the intro, man. You're full of piss and vinegar, too. You should have been a player, not an agent.
I don't know. This is my hobby, but it's something that I'm really enjoying. Thank you very much for joining us. It's not like you've got anything else going on the last 10 days.
Hey, I appreciate you guys having me on. Do you bring this much energy to your contract negotiations? Like, are you this fired up on these calls with these GMs that you have to negotiate these big ticket deals with?
So I see how it's going to be here. You're going to be interviewing me on my podcast.
Well, I'm more interested about what you got going on, so it's hard for me not to ask these fucking questions. Yeah. No,
but our next client is from Czechia.
Yeah. exactly. No, but hey, I appreciate the intro. Appreciate you guys having me on. And I was blessed to spend a little bit of time in the NHL. I was a fourth line plug, and I had a blast, and was very fortunate to have unbelievable coaches and teammates all throughout. So it was a magical run, and just grateful that I was able to transition it into media. And now I get to work with a lot of incredible people on this side too. So a lot of amazing people in the hockey world. And I think that that's kind of a message that gets lost with everything going on. It's like, there are a few bad apples, but there's so many amazing people that work in the game. And I've been fortunate to meet a lot of them.
So what has the last 10 days been like for you? Bring us a little bit into your world and tell us what it's been like for you.
It's been weird. I mean, I'm not a journalist, so that's why this has all been very difficult. And I explained it on the podcast too. Like, I don't break the story unless I have a buddy reach out who's been through the type of treatment that all this has been talked about. And if he wouldn't have reached out and explained to me that he wanted me to make more players aware that this was going on. And keep in mind, when he reached out to and he texted me at first, I had no idea what he was talking about. I knew about previous stuff that Mike Babcock had done. And I also explained on the podcast, I'm a second chance guy, and I don't know him personally. So I have no ill will towards him or anybody else who would consider giving him a second chance. But when I heard what was still going on, I felt that it was a necessity to go on and use my platform to kind of just make people aware. Now, I have a different way of delivering things sometimes because I'm a bit of a goofball that was raised in a hockey locker room. But and I don't think a lot of people took a liking to the way that I kind of mapped out what was going on and how graphic I was about it. Made some mistakes in the fact of naming Boone Jenner in the midst of all of it. But I guess to answer your question, though, my nervous system's a little shot. It wasn't very a very comfortable place for me to be. And I'd much rather just go back to talking about hockey and joking around about stuff that is pleasant rather than talking about that whole experience that the guys in Columbus had to go through, and also experiences that guys in the past who have reached out have been through too. So no place in the game for it. You know, as we were talking about before we hit record, we're all for accountability. I've had some stern coaches along the way. Like, I think of off the top of my head, Mike Stothers, who I love and I still talk to this day. He kept us accountable. Yes, he would call us out in the locker room, but it was ultimately just about hockey, and you knew where you stood with him, not a mind game which he was playing in order to try to bring you down or mess with you.
Or doing things like invading your privacy, or playing a role where you feel intimidated. At the end of the day, being a head coach or a general manager is a very powerful position, and you have an extreme amount of power over players' lives. And I totally agree. You can be a hard ass. You can be demanding. You can keep everybody accountable. But there is a line that can never be crossed, and you always have to treat the people you work with respect. And you've said a couple of things in the last few days that have really resonated with me. And one of them is, we've got the players' backs. Like, don't mess with players. And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but to me, that doesn't mean you can't yell at a guy for taking a stupid penalty, or you can't scratch a guy for turning over the puck and it ends up in the back of your net. What it means to me is you don't invade people's space. You don't invade their privacy. The days of bullying younger guys is over. And now the world, hockey world, is on notice that if these things are routinely going on behind the scenes, there is an outlet that you can reach out to people like you, and these stories will get exposed. And I think that just keeps everybody on all sides honest.
I guess when I heard what had happened to my buddy, and then that was obviously still going on, I guess that some people could see where the gray area was and you know, asking players to see pictures of their family. I thought it was a little bizarre off the hop, but I could understand where people would be a little bit confused. But as the story got dug deeper, I think everybody with a brain can understand exactly what was going on, especially how it started with Jarmo. And the fact that he it's almost like he was being strategic about it. Like, he did it with Jarmo a certain way, where the way that they described in the press release, that was the case, but still odd that he would agree and ask to see his photos. It's bizarre behavior to me. But then to hear what he was doing to the younger players, and then as far as like going into text messages, I mean, not only just an invasion of privacy, but just, it doesn't have anything to do with the game. And you just said it, like, I guess some people who work at regular jobs might not understand how it's normal, where if, like, let's say like an Amazon delivery guy forgets to drop off a package, like, I probably wouldn't imagine that his boss could be like, I can't believe you forgot to drop off this package. Like, what are you doing? Right. Like, where, like, there's HR involved and it's just like, okay, well, this person's not doing a good job, so we probably have to let them go. Where the hockey locker room can be a hostile place because there's a lot on the line. And I think that people can understand that, but there's such a difference to what was going on, not only in the past before he was let go from Toronto. You think that at a certain point he would have went away for 4 years and understood that this type of behavior as to what he was doing now was just unacceptable. And it just goes back to the fact that I think that he just, because he kept getting paid by Toronto and then he got to step into another job as soon as his contract was done being paid out, that he could just kind of go back to his old ways, where this is not hockey related. This is like mental warfare type stuff. And if you're going to, and I would imagine that no other coaches in the league are doing this type of stuff now. Like that there just simply can't be somebody in power as a head coach in the NHL that is going beyond their means to create this much stress in the locker room and their environment.
It seems like a lot of energy wasted on not getting anywhere. Like, you know, you kind of, I think in the original clip, you're like, just focus on the power play or something, you know, like do some. So I wanted to kind of ask, because Biz, you said you've had tough coaches. And this was like a manner in which you know, Babs got to quote unquote know people. How did your coaches, your toughest coaches, get to know you in training camp? What's the normal course of action for all of us that never played hockey at a high level?
I would say, though, that, like, I mean, at least from my experience, like, at first, you don't really get to know them that well on a personal level. Like, they might ask you a couple questions, but there's 25 guys in the locker room. They have their own job to worry about. And like you just talked about, like, worrying about the power play and other things in order to instill to get your group to be successful. So that's why I was so surprised. It seems like a lot of energy wasted on maybe like an insecurity that he had about these players. Probably, well, one, he's probably looking to see if they're partying and what type of stuff they're up to in their camera roll, but obviously going through text to understand what is being said about him. It's like, well, obviously you probably don't have the full trust of your players early on based on your history. Well, hey, buddy, it just so happens that you're going to have to now earn that. So, yeah, I've had coaches in the past like ask me, oh, how is the family? How is this and that? But never to the degree where they're calling you in and having like an hour conversation about like, oh yeah, so what's your dog's name? What's your grandma like? Oh, what did she do? And like, there's just simply not enough time in order for that type of stuff to get known, at least right off the hop. That's something that's going to happen with, let's say, a core player over the course of 4 or 5 years, where now you start getting comfortable like anybody else would in a working environment, right? Like when you meet a buddy for the first time, are you going through their phone and searching this and getting to know every little detail about their life? No, it's pretty casual, and you do it the normal way, how most people do it. And if that is somebody's style, by saying, hey, I typically liked, because you talk to certain players who played for him in Toronto, and there has been cases where he would have guys do a presentation and post pictures up on a board in front of the locker room in order to do a little presentation to explain where you come from, what your parents did. And that all seems normal, fine, and well. But this was obviously a different approach that it kind of snowballed, and he got more and more comfortable asking to see players' phones. And then obviously, considering he did it to the older guys and he got the okay, when it got to the younger guys, well, I guess if the older guys are doing it, I guess it's not a problem if I do it. But there's a difference between asking if it's okay and then just saying, hey, hand over your phone. And from what I've heard also, that wasn't even the case with the older guys. It was right to give me your phone, just like it was the case for the player who reached out to me. There wasn't an asking process. It was more of a hand it over. And quickly, that just goes to Alan's part about establishing that power dynamic, where he's obviously unaware that that is even a thing, if that's the case, where it's making guys uncomfortable, where if you say no, well, what's the consequence for that? They don't know.
And you know, like to me, there's GMs that I have gotten to know really well over the years, coaches I've gotten to know really well over the years. This is my 29th year in the business doing what I do. And there are many people in the business today who were in the business when I started. And I'll see somebody and they'll say, how's the family? And I know it's sincere. And it's somebody that I've known for 25, 26, 29 years. But for a person I've just met today, who's going to be a coach of a team, to say, like, let me see a picture of your family, or tell me about your family, does it really fucking matter? Do you care? I just don't think there's a sincerity behind it. You got 25 guys that you got to focus on, maybe more, maybe 28 to 30. You know, when they're coming into camp, I mean, does it matter if, you know, one guy has a wife and three kids and one guy has a wife and one kid and a dog? I mean, does it make a difference at the end of the day? Is it a break the ice way of starting off a conversation and relating? Well, can't you have that conversation? Can't you say, tell me a little bit about your family without the visual? So leave the phone out of it. So that to me right away when I heard it, it was like, I don't know if this feels right. I don't know if this passes the smell test.
And for most people who might not see it as like that awkward or that offside, the reason I took the stance that I did was also because a prior player for him reached out to me to say that's not how it was going down where we played for him, where it was more of an authoritarian thing and more that he was snooping. So that's why I came from the certain stance. So that kind of left it very much in a gray area when the statement was released, where it's like, well, it seems like these guys were comfortable with it. And another thing too, it's like, what are Boone Jenner and Johnny Gaudreau supposed to say about that? If they throw their coach under the bus and it, as a result, he doesn't get fired because it seems like management was willing to stick up for him all the way till the end. Well, then that all of a sudden their lives become a living hell. Like, you don't think there's going to be retribution for putting your coach on blast for doing something that made them uncomfortable. And another thing too, it's like, if it didn't make them uncomfortable, why was this story spreading like wildfire throughout the players? Do you talk about a normal interaction you had with your head coach with a bunch of people about saying how uncomfortable it was? No, you have a conversation with your coach that was positive in a growth experience. And then you leave the room and you leave it at that. And it was like, oh, that was great. And that's it. It stays there. It's done, right?
Well, I got a question exactly. for both of you about that specific point, Paul. Why do the players feel more comfortable coming to you than they did to the NHLPA or the Blue Jackets? And I wanted to ask you both that question because, you know, there is a thing in hockey about upsetting the apple cart and going your own way. This doesn't seem like going your own way. This just seems like it's really weird. Why do you think that exists?
I think that this is a one-off case, at least for right now. I want to praise the NHLPA for the way that they handled this when it was brought to their attention. They didn't just go away after the initial allegations were basically swatted away. They dug deep and they found the root of the problem and then ended up executing on it. So I guess I don't know the answer to that. I think that maybe they don't feel comfortable going because if word ends up getting back to management and they're being a disruptor and maybe they're not a star player who's locked into a contract, next thing you know, you find yourself having a one-way ticket to the American League and then your career's over. Like, I don't think people understand how much in control these people are of your destiny in the National Hockey League. And these kids would rather just live in that silence and make sure not to fuck it up and continue to get that opportunity to live out their dream. So this is not a witch hunt by any means. I think the NHLPA does a great job and I think that they did a great job on this. And same with what I said earlier, like there's so many amazing people in the game. I don't want to rip on the NHL either. This was like an isolated incident.
It's one guy.
Where Yarmo thought that this guy has rehabilitated himself enough to give him a second opportunity as to why I didn't think Yarmo should get fired, because I heard he has a big heart. Like, where are we in society if we don't think that somebody can actually rehabilitate by going away for 4 years and basically being publicly embarrassed by what his antics were the first time? Because it wasn't like everybody wasn't made aware of what this guy was doing. And to the point where, yeah, he was pretty much publicly humiliated because stories like, for instance, that came out on our podcast from Chris Chelios, people around the arena, like the people who were working the concession stands, were putting money on the board against the Leafs, their first game back at Joe Louis. How does the fucking concessions guy, pardon my French, have that much ill will towards a head coach of a National Hockey League team?
Alan, I have the same question. What would you advise your client to do if they come to you with this same sort of thing?
Well, if a client came to me and said, I had an interaction and I didn't feel comfortable, I felt like this went over the line, I think players know me well enough to know that I'm going to stand up for the player and I'm going to do what I can to remedy the situation. And I don't care what it is. Maybe depending on the personalities involved, I would address it directly with the coach. Maybe I would address it with the general manager. Maybe I would address it with the owner of the team. There's maybe based on the situation, I would recommend the player go in and talk to a GM or talk to an owner, or maybe we go in together. But I would, it's just not in me to let something like that go unless the player really wants to let it go. because he doesn't want to jeopardize what he perceives to be his future with the organization. But I would find a way to send a message one way or the other that this better not happen again. And I just think that when I got into this business, there were certain things that I stood for, certain values that I fashioned when I got into this business, and I wasn't going to compromise them for anybody. And I really don't care. I mean, Biz, you've taken on a lot of criticism for things that you've said over the years. I get the sense from you, knowing you and seeing some of the things that you said, that you have conviction. And you're going to stand up and say what's right, what you believe is right. We all make mistakes. We all make mistakes. I've made plenty. You've made plenty. And we all learn from them. But you have a basic level of values where I am going to be the person who will stand up and have the players back in the face of some grave injustice. And I think similar. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I respect you so much and enjoy what you do and appreciate you, because you are willing to do that.
Yeah, like I said, I don't really want to take credit for it. It's just, I usually just pass over the praise to the player that reached out to me, the PA, and a lot of the media who had to do the heavy lifting on this. Like, I just try to use my platform to make people aware of this. And I guess I just look back to the fact that not only my buddy, but people that he'd done this to in the past, if he was willing to do it to players of that stature, what are the players who don't really have any type of long-term contract or no quote unquote value, at least in his eyes, what are they going to have to go through it? And as the stories kept rolling in after we originally mentioned it, it was obvious that this guy shouldn't be in that position, because the stories kept getting worse and worse with how he was going about his business. So
Biz, I
appreciate that, okay. Alan, but like, go ahead. Sir. No, go ahead, Adam. Sorry.
The only reason I want to jump in is that I have a couple questions, but obviously I think, you know, I think people would be surprised by your response here, because I think people assume that you enjoyed this process. They assume that you know, and I'm gonna go full Twitter weirdo on you here, okay? Accusations of, he did this for the clicks. He's loving this moment. He loves this, you know, he's loving the spotlight, all that stuff before the story was confirmed, obviously. You know, you said at the beginning of this show that this was really uncomfortable. Why?
Well, just because of first off, there was there's going to be pushback, right? There's going to be denial. And then, you know, you have people questioning on whether you're lying about a serious allegation. So that didn't feel great. And just just obviously seeing the worst stories roll in, oh God, these younger kids had to deal with that. That's messed up. Excuse me.
You can swear.
And then just
it's okay.
Overall, it's not the type of attention that I want. Like I said, I want to go on and joke about hockey and funny things and trade rumors and all that type of stuff. The stuff that makes it fun to follow hockey, not this type of stuff. So yeah, no, it was uncomfortable. Like all the journalists that I talked to, I reached out. I'm like, I don't know how you guys do this all the time, because this is just I got my nervous system was shot, and then I just had that that sick feeling for a week, just not knowing how it was all going to transpire. And I'm not looking for sympathy on that. It's just something that I'm not comfortable with, and I don't know how journalists go about it all the time in order to do that for their work. I mean, I know there's Westhead and a bunch of other guys who do this all the time. So my cap goes off to them for trying to protect people. And it's just not a business, not the reason I got involved in the business at all.
Fair enough.
Let me ask you, because I've always been curious.
And just quickly to go back out, I don't bring up, if that player would have told me about it and said, don't say anything, I wouldn't have mentioned it on the podcast.
Right.
I tweeted out the message I got. He goes, you got to let people, he goes, you got to sneak this on the pod. And when I talked to him, he was like, yeah, you got to give these guys the heads up. So I was like, oh, okay. And I don't know if I've already mentioned this, but when he told me that, I was going over the outline with Witt, and I'm like, oh yeah, by the way, have you heard about any of this stuff? And he's like, no, at the time he hadn't. So when we were in the midst of recording the podcast, I hadn't written it down. So he brought it up. He's like, oh yeah, do you want to bring this up? And then that's why I was so flustered and then accidentally mentioned Boone Jenner's name, which I regret to this day. And then I was, you know, obviously we have a way of like talking and joking around about certain situations. And I probably shouldn't have joked around about it either from like the lightheartedness of mentioning what might've been in the pictures, but it was also I was thinking about it from an older player perspective where you can't really bully and manipulate as much as you can an older guy as you can a younger guy, where this player ended up having fuck you matches with Mike Babcock later on where he was sticking up for himself. So I know I was long-winded with my answer, but just there was a lot to it.
Absolutely.
When did you first start to think about working in media? Were you still playing when you started thinking about, hey, maybe this is something that I would like to do? Because you're a natural in front of the camera.
Yeah, I appreciate that. As soon as my last year, I tore both my ACLs. So I tore my one ACL. Geez. I tried to prehab it to come back and finish the season on it. Did so. And then in my first game back, tore my other one. Can't make it up, right? So at that point, I think there was like probably 5 to 10 games left in that season. And then we had playoffs when I was playing in Ontario. And I think the writing was on the wall that my career was going to be over. And there was an opportunity to do the radio with the Arizona Coyotes. And I just figured since I'd already been tweeting and joking around and had a platform in that regard, it just seemed like an easier transition. And you know, something that I could feel comfortable doing where I was going to be on Coyotes radio, where it would be a good place to get my feet wet. And I had a great friend in Rich Nairn, who actually just finished his 27-year career working in PR. He just announced it before we hopped on. He gave me the opportunity to step in that role. And because that I loved it in the desert when I played here, I had a bunch of friends here and was comfortable here. It was just seemed like the right thing to do. And then from there, jumped in. And then also you talk about the camera thing because of when I finished my NHL career, which is 3 years prior before retiring, I finished my last year of my deal with the Coyotes and then I couldn't get a contract. So I was sitting on my couch for a month and I was like basically full on depressed. And I think that scared me to understand that when it's all over, nobody's going to save you. Like you need to figure out now what it is that you want to do and you need to be proactive about it. So even though I knew I had the Coyotes job coming, I did a film project called Biz Does BC. So I learned a ton about like logistics, you know, booking my own hotels, like funding a project, being in front of the camera, reaching out to players to like interact with them on camera. So from that experience, I gained a lot of knowledge about a lot of things on about how to drive my own bus. And that's what ended up leading to help out with the podcast. But it was more about just being that, taking that proactive approach because I had gone through that period of depression when my career was taken for me for no one's fault, but the fact that I just didn't have a job, right? It's just like, can happen to anybody. Right. So yeah, that kind of scared me to the point where I just would refuse to just sit down and feel sorry for myself, where I wanted to get after it. And that's kind of how it all propelled.
Yeah. I've had a lot of players over the years tell me that as they approach the end of their career in that first couple of months after, into the summer when they're not signed and after camp starts, and really it's the first year you remember of your entire life where you're not going to a training camp somewhere and you're at home, you know, usually alone, that guys feel, you know, depressed, very isolated, don't know what to do with themselves, you know, many times don't have a job, don't have any direction. You know, the savings are starting to dwindle and there's a real panic that sets in. It's like, oh my God, I'm 28 years old or I'm 30 years old. What am I going to do with the rest of my life? And I know it's something that over the years I've had a lot of discussions with the NHLPA about, with regard to continuing education, internships, and there's a new program that has been started. Chris Campoli, Campy at the PA, yep, has done an amazing job. And I mean, this is, you know, his baby, and he is helping guys take business classes at renowned universities and interning with some Fortune 500 companies and, you know, getting experience, getting financial literacy, business literacy, and helping them with that transition. And I know the Alumni Association, you know, also does a much better job now since Heels is there than they ever did in the past, where they were largely invisible. You know, Glenn Healy is really on top of it and is literally working around the clock 24 hours a day to help guys in that transition. What more do you think needs to be done?
Well, that's another thing. I was just going to compliment the league on some of the steps they are taking. You mentioned what Campoli is doing to help these guys, you know, while they're playing, take some classes where the transition becomes easier. Like, even going back to what I talked about, like, I went through that bout of about a month of depression. I was able to reach out to the NHL doctors, and they were able to give me advice on taking, like, holistic approaches instead of just, like, relying on going to take medication to deal with it. Now, I understand some people, some things can be severe where they have to lean on medication to get through it, but just to be able to reach out to them and talk to them, like, there are systems in place to help the guys, and it is getting better and better and better, right? And you learn from experience, at least from the league standpoint. So I'm happy to see that they are taking all these approaches, and throughout the process that I was through, I'm grateful that people before me had done this. Like, even going back to even the LA Kings, right? Like, they dealt with the Voinov situation. So the next year at training camp, we ended up sitting down for 2 hours with a man and woman who talked about, like, the domestic violence stuff, to explain, you know, how to, you know, if you guys are getting amplified and you're arguing, leave the house, like little steps where maybe where some guys, I don't know what type of household they came from, but to take that type of approach. What else did the LA Kings do? They had a guy named Brant Myers.
Brant Myers brought him in.
Where if a player was having a problem, if he was abusing drugs or alcohol, or he, you know, dealing with any type of personal problem that maybe they didn't feel comfortable about going to management with, he was there as a softener. I just, because he was around, I ended up talking to him. He was the person who told me to go set up an LLC when I retired, and ended up helping me in that way, where I didn't even know what any of that stuff meant. You know, I'm just a dumb hockey player that didn't go to college, right? I barely graduated high school, if it wasn't for my mom helping me write some of my essays, for crying out loud. But there are plenty of things that have been done and are still being done that I'm very proud for the league for taking that approach. And I really want, like, this conversation. I'm glad you guys are asking and we're having this conversation about, this was not a witch hunt and bash the league, bash this. Like, there's a lot of positive things being done in order to create change around the game.
Well, I think as an outsider, sometimes, guys, like, the only thing that we hear about is, and I can only represent what being a fan is. I didn't play. I've never worked for an organization. It's nice to hear that stuff exists. We never hear about it. And maybe the NHL needs to do a better job of telling us that, because I think there is the perception that they just don't care, at least among the fans. And so it's good to hear that that kind of stuff exists, that it happens. And I feel like it's interesting, Biz, when you know, listening to you talk about this and being an advocate for the players. I know that, you know, Alan is sort of the same thing. And I think that's why he really wanted you on today, besides just the Babcock stuff. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, like, your impressions as a player of Alan Walsh as an agent. You know, like, there have been some moments, there have been some Alan Walsh moments, and I don't need to get too into them, but one of them involves the sword. I wanted to know, from your perspective, what are your thoughts on a guy like Alan, who has always been outspoken in defense of the players whenever he can be?
I mean, to have somebody who cares about his players as much as Allen does, I mean, that's hard to find. I would imagine some of them were probably, I'd be curious to know what Flower said after you posted that, whether he was happy or not about it. I mean, I'm sure if he could look at his contract situations, he could probably get over it and how you go to bat and get your guys paid. But no, I think it's, I think that he's so much more knowledgeable about what's actually going on with the CBA and that type of stuff, where I'm just there to view it and listen. Like, I don't, like, some of the stuff he talks about and how he explains to me, like, I'm like, I have no idea how it plays out and why maybe it's explained as a 50-50 split between the owners and players, but what actually doesn't make it a 50-50 split. So there's a lot of things that he comes online with that I think he's just trying to teach people and make people aware of and bring people up to speed with how maybe knowledgeable and intelligent the owners are with keeping as much money as they can. So, and once again, that's not to rip on the owners. That's not to rip on the league. At the end of the day, it's a negotiation and they're highly intelligent people. I just think he's trying to make people aware of what the facts are, especially when it comes to that. As far as the stuff with the players, that's more of a question for Allen. I don't know how your guys feel about, like, what did Fleury say when you did that? Like, did he say, Allen, you can't be doing that, man. Come on.
One day I'm going to write a book, and I'm saving all those stories for the book.
There you go. There you go.
Still you hasn't go. Told me either. That's like, not even privately. Not even privately.
Yeah, you don't want to indulge all your secrets.
Yeah,
I can tell you, Biz, that you know, going back to the 12-13 lockout, I remember you being very active on Twitter at that time, advocating for the players during the lockout. I mean, you were locked out for half a season. Tell us what you remember of that time and what you thought as a player going through that whole process, not knowing if you're going to play that year or not. I mean, it went down to the last 48 hours in January. The league was threatening to cancel the season. What do you remember from that time?
Obviously, very vulnerable. Because I was just, you know, I was a pigeon not knowing if I was even going to get another contract. So, I was just vocal because I had Shane Doan and other smart guys in my corner explaining to me, like, what exactly we were fighting for and why they were fighting for it. And I think that ultimately we got to an okay place. But, it's hard for me to remember exactly other than the fact that it was a little bit upsetting because every 2 weeks that went by, you're like, oh man, I'm losing out on money. And you knew that the owners could sit out and they didn't need hockey to be played in order for their livelihoods to continue. Cause most of them are rich enough where this is just their little play toy. Right. So, but was very fortunate that we had a lot of players, who are smart enough to go to bat for us. And I think that probably like the biggest takeaway, if moving forward, I would say maybe not concerned so ourselves so much with the top line, but more so what's the worst case scenario? Like, can all the players' medical be taken care of for a certain amount of time for them and their families once they're done playing, after they've played maybe a certain amount of time? One big thing from that lockout is every year you played after the point where the deal was signed is you would have, I think, $20,000 towards a pool where and maxed up to 10 years where when you reached a certain age, you would be like, for instance, I played two and a half years as of that lockout. And I think that when I reach 55 or 60 years old, every year after that, I'll get $50,000 like as a retirement fund.
For the rest of your life.
Which,
yeah. And, you know, and if you unfortunately pass away before your spouse or partner, your partner will continue getting that money until she dies.
Wow.
Right. So just like even that, like that was like a big thing where I think that players, if they're moving forward, yeah, maybe the top line won't be as heavy, but just make sure you're fighting to help with your security where when the dark days come, you've taken care of yourself. The healthcare thing would probably be one that I would try to fight for next if I was a player. Like, because now obviously I have to pay for my own health care, but you know, some people are like, oh, boo-hoo, millionaire. You know, you made millions playing hockey, shut up. But I would just say with the league making as much as they are, if that was one thing that you could win in the negotiation, I would say aim for that. Especially for guys, it's expensive to have kids. And I think certain insurance packages for families are like, what, 20, 25 grand a year?
They could actually, right now, it could cost players over 30 if they have, you know, wife and kids. $30,000 a year. And when retired players ever hit a financial bump in the road, the first thing they stop paying, you got to pay the mortgage, you need a place to live, you got to make the car payment, you got to keep driving a car to get to where you need to go. The first thing that goes is the health insurance.
Yeah.
And God forbid you then get sick or need medical care with no health insurance in the United States, one event could wipe you out.
Yeah.
You're right. One event could wipe you out. Literally cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars.
I was listening to a podcast and they say that I think the biggest reason for personal debt in the United States is
bankruptcy.
Yes. Healthcare bankruptcy.
Right. Right. It's crazy. And I think that, and the other thing is if a player loses his health insurance and then recovers financially where he's now able to make payments, you can never get back on the plan.
Right.
Once you're forfeited out of the retired player's plan, you've had it, you're retired from the NHL, you've been paying for insurance for 8 years, 10 years, you hit some hard times financially, you can't pay, the insurance is canceled for non-payment of premium. A year later, you know, you get a new job, you're making more money, you're able to now pay for it, you can't get back on the plan. It's just, there's a lot of roadblocks there. My dream, and something that I advocate to every single day to players playing in the league right now, because the younger guys in the league today are going to be the guys at the table in 3 years and 4 years.
Yeah.
And however long that CBA is, they might actually be around for two negotiations. You've got to take care of the retired players today. Now there's a health stipend. There's about a $3,000 payment a year that will go towards insurance. It's not enough. It's a drop in the bucket. It's better than nothing, but it's just a little bit better than nothing. There is no reason why, if guys play a certain number of games in the NHL, the NBPA does it. There needs to be an agreement between the league and the union that they're going to take care of this for players and their families. That's the least the game owes these guys, in my opinion.
Hard to disagree with that. Had no idea about that, by the way, that if you're off, you're off forever. That's pretty wild. Guys, you know, I think one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because Paul, obviously you have an enormous podcast. Alan's just kicking off season three with you here. Tell me about what inspired you guys to even start Chicklets in the first place. How did that even get going? And, you know, what you think of podcasting in general, because obviously, you know, you got your TNT stuff, you had the Coyotes radio and stuff, but I think so much of what's happened is due to what you and Witt have done with Chicklets.
Well, so him and RA, the host, had already started it. And then Grinnell obviously hopped on a little bit after Witt had joined. I went on as a guest a couple times, and then finally they asked me to join towards the end of my first season with the Coyotes. And I said, hey, let me just finish my first year, and then after it, we can announce that I'll be joining. But then after this season, my first season with the Coyotes, after I got my feet wet, then I felt comfortable. And then we were actually able to release that that Biz Does BC like mockumentary thing that I ended up doing. But the biggest thing why it's fun for me is, and we touched on it earlier, it's hard for not only the guys transitioning where, you know, they don't know where their next paychecks are going to be coming from. All of a sudden they can't play hockey anymore, which is a thing they've been doing their whole life. But for me, considering I was a healthy scratch and I wasn't even playing that much to begin with, was the camaraderie and the jokes and the talking of with guys in the locker room. All of a sudden, like, you're not around your buddies all the time, where, you know, I'm sure we all get sick of our buddies sometimes when we're around them too much. But when you go from a livelihood when you're going to the rink every single day and that's all that you know, and then all of a sudden nobody's there, it makes it extremely difficult. So that's the coolest thing, and the thing I love about it most now is just getting these guys on, having conversation, talking hockey, and then of course talking to players that I didn't play with or didn't know, and hearing some of their unbelievable stories, whether they're funny, whether they're inspirational, whether the way that they got their break to get in the NHL was just like, what? We just had Pierre Cedric Labrie on, a former player who played with John Cooper. And it was cool because I know we were talking about the whole Babcock situation, but there's so many amazing coaches like John Cooper and how well that he treated him. And he goes on to tell a story, but before that, how he was basically ready to quit hockey and he was painting inside the arena of the junior team, in which the GM would walk by and he somehow talked to him to give him a tryout. And he finally made the major junior team as an overager in his hometown, where, you know, and then this guy goes from, he's probably going to be working a regular desk job or working construction, to painting inside the arena of his hometown building, to seeing the GM go by to have a cigarette and saying, you need to bring me on this team. Like, I could do for you guys. And then somehow talk him in. Like I said, he goes on to play major junior as an overage, gets an opportunity to play in the coast, goes up to the American Hockey League, and meets John Cooper, and then finally eventually gets his break in the NHL with the Tampa Bay Lightning. So just like hearing stories like that, it's just like, it makes it so much, it makes the job incredible, and it doesn't even feel like a job most days. So we're very fortunate that it's taken on a mind of its own, and we've had the success, because I don't know what the trick is or why all these people started to come to listening, but it's working. The chemistry with me and the guys works, and I'm grateful that they started it and that I was able to come on board, and it's been able to get to where it's got.
Does it ever feel like a job to you, or?
Well, it did this week.
Yeah.
This is for sure.
Yeah. But it usually doesn't feel like a job to you. You have a lot of fun doing it, and there isn't a grind to having to put out the content all the time.
Yeah, I think that being depressed on my couch kind of instilled something in me to where I don't think I'm ever satisfied, but like, I guess in some ways it's negative, in some ways it's positive, because it keeps you moving forward. And like, I think in life we all have to have goals and you know, trying to bring it further and do more things. Like, we've started doing these ball hockey tournaments like Chicklets Cup. We've done live shows before, and just like organizing all this stuff. I guess it's more like, yeah, it feels like a job, but we're challenging ourselves to bring us experiences that we would have never been able to experience in our life. So with that does come the work, but most days, no, it doesn't feel like a job. It just feels you've put in the work to gain these unbelievable experiences.
And your fans are pretty intense. Alan, I don't know if you remember this last summer, but we'd all been complaining about Pearson Airport here in Toronto, and Whitney came through, posts one video, and then all of a sudden, you know, I know he had a really terrible experience and was stuck there for a day, but like, the Canadian transport minister at the federal level had to talk about it. I think that's pretty crazy.
That was pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, that one, another thing that took a mind of its own, and we ended up having him on one of our live streams.
Oh yeah.
Because it was going on during COVID, and we would do like, we live stream games sometimes, and we bring on special guests, and he spoke about it in Parliament. So we're like, hey, we got a special guest, and we brought him on board, and It was a pretty funny interaction. Maybe got a little bit awkward after there was really nothing to talk about other than the Pearson experience. But yeah, that was wild. Pearson Airport. What happened was they just laid so many people off when everything was shut down, where those people said, well, if you're going to lay me off, I'm not coming back to this, you know, this grungy job when things start moving again. So everything, all of a sudden things started moving again, and it just, they had to retrain and they couldn't get enough people hired because nobody wanted to do the job anymore. And the Pearson Airport turned into an absolute show.
I was stuck in Pearson several times trying to get through customs on my way back to LA or just flying to New York. And one time took 4 hours to get through the security line and then the customs line, right? Oh. To get through that. It was painful.
Painful.
It was painful. And, you know, Global Entry, Nexus, didn't do anything. No, didn't do anything. So
it's the worst airport in North America. Really nice staff. Everybody's awesome, but it's the absolute worst airport. And it's kind of shocking when you go through O'Hare or you go through the one in Minnesota, like the real international hubs, how they just roll people through like it's nothing. Pearson smooth. Just can't do it.
Yeah. Smooth.
Yeah. Well, listen, Biz, you've been very generous with your time. I'm sure you got a busy day ahead of you, rest of the day ahead of you, and you got things to do, and trouble to cause. And I certainly don't want to get in the way of any of that. Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us and sharing some great stories. And I want you to know I really appreciate it. You're a legend. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you guys, first of all. Congratulations on kicking off season 3 of your podcast.
Thanks,
Bob. Appreciate all the work you guys do in shedding light on a lot of important subjects. And Alan, to you, like, you know, you help us gain a lot of knowledge as to what's happening behind the scenes on things that we're not educated on. So I appreciate your friendship and everything that you've helped explain to me throughout the years, my friend. And just no more memes of your players with knives in the back. All right. And to Adam and Jesse, keep kicking ass as well. I see your guys' clips online all the time. You guys do an awesome job. And thank you for your professionalism and for this awesome conversation.
This has been Agent Provocateur with Alan Walsh and Adam Wild. Follow Alan Walsh on Twitter at Walsh A. Subscribe wherever you get your podcast by searching Agent Provocateur and hitting the subscribe button, youtube.com/SDPN.